Hey everybody, time for another Shop Talk show. This is episode number 235. Just Mr. Dave and I doing as much question on answer action as we possibly can. For example, isn't it annoying when you click a link from an email newsletter and you pop over to their site and read their site and then a pop-up comes up asking if you want to join their newsletter? Can't we do something about that? That's a little weird. Someone wrote in asking that, you know, like kind of letting us know that their work in programming has been beneficial to their real life in some way. So we'll talk about that in a little bit of a way. We're going to talk about SAS placeholder classes. Are they a miracle? Are they the best thing that ever happened to web development, or what's going on with that? We're going to talk about some performance stuff, like can the web get any slower? Are we approaching like a peak point of web slowness where the camel's back breaks, or whatever metaphor is appropriate there? Lots of stuff to talk about, that stuff and many more things on this episode of Shop Talk Show. I should mention the fact that we have a sponsor this week, a brand new sponsor called Theme Juice. The URL is themejuice.it, and it's a Mac app for doing lots of very powerful WordPress stuff. You know, like it helps you spin up local WordPress sites and then does a lot more than that. Database migrations, giving you a local DNS server, like customizing starter templates, including themes and plugins and all that stuff. Very powerful software to check out. We'll tell you more about that as we move on with the show. But for now, Mr. Dave, please kick things off.
Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about suits and web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Wow, that was emphatic. Yeah, last week we're in suits. This week, not so much. But I am wearing a sweater because it has become fall here. But I am, you know, I've listened to enough podcasts where they talk about what they're wearing and what they're drinking and stuff, and it's really obnoxious. I just was on a road trip, and it just happened too much. So we're not going to do that to you. Let's get right into it. Oh. We have one from Stacey Kvernmo, a friend of the show who always has wonderful things to say about the topics and stuff. Maybe I don't think we've had Stacey on as a guest, but we should very soon. But in lieu of that, Dave, do you have it all queued up?
Can we? It's all queued up. Stacey called in audio, called in and wanted to give us her point of view on a heavy topic we kind of broke into last week on our special 234th episode. So this is Stacey, and let's listen.
Hey, Chris and Dave, this is Stacey Kvernmo. I just finished listening to episode 234, and you had a question there about whether traditional design was becoming less important, and maybe that's because of responsive web design. Now, I also don't think that responsive web design is at fault. It's probably more internal struggles such as timelines or getting the client on board to, you know, dedicate the right amount of resources to a project and try new things, when it's so much easier to just fall back to these established conventions that we know work-ish. Well, but what if something could be better? That's what I'm always wondering. What if we dedicate the time to explore what else is there that we maybe haven't realized yet? And I think design is your competitive advantage. When everything is the same, there's so many similar priced apps or services, and the feature sets are all the same. Design is what sets you apart from your competitors. So instead of thinking design is a solved problem, maybe we invest more time and energy into exploring ways that we can more creatively, or at least uniquely, communicate our brand through not only our content and in our text that we use, but also through our design and art direction. But all this said, I am a designer, and obviously I have a biased opinion about the role that design should play through our projects. I just wanted to share that with you and tell you that I still love the show. Keep up the great work, guys. Love the suits.
Well, thanks, Stacey. I like that. I like thinking of it as one of the competitive advantages that you might have as a business. And the reason I've been thinking about it is, and the reason I said one of, is because it's true. There's a number of things you can do. Of course, you could have really great customer service, or you could, you know, have a native app when somebody else doesn't, or something. Although that's not a favorable one to talk about on a web show, is it? The one that, you know, I think of this. You know, I was speaking with, I don't know what the timing of these shows are, so I'm not even going to tell you all the details of what released when. But I was talking with some fellas, and the subject of bug tracking apps came up, right? And they're to some sense, you know, no offense to anybody that runs a bug tracker. I know some very nice people that do. They're kind of a dime a dozen. There's no shortage of bug tracking apps out there in the world. They're kind of crud apps, you know. They're kind of just like, yeah, hopefully you have a good feature set and good integrations and stuff, but there's not like a lot of like super interesting deep tech in a bug tracking app. So what is the competitive advantage? Well, as Stacey said, design might be one of them. If it's really nicely designed, I could see people going with you just because of that design. Imagine a bug tracking app that was just only built on Bootstrap. And again, we've talked about Bootstrap too much. It's a little bit cliche. I apologize for that. But, you know, you can imagine you'd just be like, you know, it just doesn't have any spirit, probably. If it was just an off-the-shelf design, even if it had amazing features, it probably just won't feel right. You know, it probably should have a little bit more personality than that. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I appreciate Stacey's point of view. As a designer, I'm thinking, you know, I'm staring at a Trello board right now that we used kind of to plan Shop Talk. And, you know, what's the difference between Trello and Basecamp to-do list or something? Kind of nothing, right? It's, you can just organize little lines of text, right? But for some reason, Trello feels maybe a little better. And so there's something to say about, like, you know, the design is the differentiator. And so I totally agree with that. And what I also liked that Stacey kind of said was, you know, these established patterns are fallbacks. I thought that was kind of a cool way to think about it. You know, you have fallback patterns. Everything in Brad Frost's This Is Responsive Patterns or whatever is the fallback in that you make better. You kind of progressively enhance or come up with your own way of making a pattern better. Yeah. I'm super down for like finding new patterns and exploring, right. But you also,
it doesn't mean that, like, what was that word that we've been overusing? Affordances. It doesn't, affordances. You know, just because you have a unique design or a fancy design doesn't mean that it doesn't have any affordances. You know, I'm sure you can make tabs something that is, it has affordances on the web. You know, if you make things look like they kind of have tabs, it's fairly clear. I mean, you know, we mentioned Trello. Trello has a very like kind of basic, but you know, the more and more I use it, I think kind of beautiful design because of, just, I don't know, you get used to it a little bit, and it's very clear how everything works, and things work just kind of how you hope they work and stuff. I think there's a lot of affordances at work in Trello, but there's no reason it couldn't, you know, have similar things going on, you know, little dashed lines that means drag me around, that means those dashed lines could be really unique and animated and whatever, you know what
I mean. Well, and I think there's also, like, you know, what the nuance that didn't come across in the previous episode, you know, is that I think your content determines what kind of pattern you should use or what kind of, you know, structure of the content you should go for. And I think, you know, that's kind of what is going to make good designers and bad designers, is that there are people who know what kind of pattern to use for, you know, what kind of content. You know, if you think of like a list of five things, you know, should it go vertically or horizontally? And if you do it horizontally, that's a totally different thing than go vertically. You know, if you had to like browse your Netflix vertically, you know, only vertically, that would be a little difficult, you know? So maybe horizontal is the way to go there. I don't know that. I think there's kind of like, I think there's definitely like ground to break in ways to do things different and better than your competitors. And I think that's another part of design is standing out by zagging when everyone's zigging, you know, when everyone's doing flat design, you put a little nice, you know, gradient on your button, man. And that looks beautiful. And people go, oh, wow, this site's so different. I think that's kind of I think that's a skill too, a design skill, is kind of know when to kind of countercurrent the trends.
Yeah, the notion that, like, you know, if there's any big statement like design is dead or something, you know, I would hope that we could all agree that that's pretty laughable. This conversation is far too big, far too nuanced for that. We have one here, another one. Let's change subjects here. Saith Renshaw, who has an awesome question, I think, or observation about email newsletters and them getting sent out. Why do sites that you have subscribed to their email list not remember that when you open a link from their newsletter? So imagine you get a newsletter and you're like, oh, here's an interesting link. I'm going to click over to their site and look at it. And you go to their site and a big pop-up comes up that asks you to subscribe to their newsletter. That's a really good point, though. I can, you know, like, let's say you're one of those sites that you really want people to sign up to your newsletter. So, I'm a believer in the call to action on the web. I think if you want people to ask to sign up for your newsletter, you should ask, and you should ask in a very clear, big, bold way. Maybe not something that overlays content or anything, but, you know, my current one on CSS Tricks, when you get to the bottom, there's a lot of white space around it and says, we got a newsletter, and there's a big input there, and it's really easy and clear to sign up for. What could, you know, I don't think that's all that annoying, so I'm probably not going to do anything like big and fancy to hide that or anything, but let's say you do, you know, do something a little bit more intense than that. You know, you have something that slides out on mobile or something like that. It seems to me that it really wouldn't be that hard to have a URL parameter that you add to all of your links in your newsletter that just stops that from happening. I mean, you know that they came from the newsletter if it's got that URL parameter, so just don't show it, right?
Yeah, well, it would seem, it would seem like any email would have like a UTM source or a UTM campaign flag, right? Those are kind of the standard tracking marketing tags.
Pretty standard, yeah. I would think like MailChimp or Campaign Monitor or whatever would add those for you if you wanted them to.
Yeah, so it's almost like if you detect that, you should just bail, you know, unless like it's UTM source Twitter or something. And then you're like, oh, yeah, I'm going to like hit these Twitter people with a Twitter, you know.
Sure.
Like, hey, follow us on Twitter or something, because you know they're a Twitter user. Or
so if you came from the newsletter, I think that sounds like a really reasonable thing to do, is to not show it to those newsletter people as a thank you, at least for signing up for the newsletter. But what about, you know, like what if they have signed up for your newsletter, but this time they didn't come? They came over from Twitter this time, but they do already have your newsletter. Is there anything you can do in that circumstance? I was kind of thinking, like, if there's any login component at all to your website, and you can detect through their login that they already are a member of your newsletter or whatever else, you should probably not show it. But a lot of sites, there just isn't, you know, like if I click over to read something on Washington Post or something, they don't really know anything about me.
Well, you can drop a cookie. I mean, that's kind of the standard, like here's a cookie. This is all the things I know about this person. You know, I think a lot of people kind of do that. I think you know, I mean, you might as well, if somebody's coming through on from a newsletter or something, at least, you know, then you know, like, they're...
Yeah, as soon as they actually sign up for your newsletter, then drop a really long-lasting cookie. And it's only going to work in that browser. It's only going to work till they flush their cookies. It's only going to work, you know, it's not going to work on their phone or whatever, because cookies are... They're temporal things. But, it's kind of like the least you can do, in a way.
Yeah. I mean, cookies are very based on the browser, the user, or whatever. But I think like that would be smart. I mean, you know, we probably need to do like an analytics show, Chris. We probably need to like put something like that together, just like how to do it really, really well. I know you've done some of that stuff on CodePen Radio, so maybe we could point people to those posts. But But like there is like an art to doing analytics. And but I'm also now I'm like thinking of different ways you failed a user, you know, where you're just like, oh, well, they visited from this and I, you know, showed them this redundant thing or something. I can't like think of examples, but I'm now I'm like, but my gears are spinning on
kind of, you know. I mean, we, you know, like for example, us at CodePen, we really want you to upgrade to pro. That's how we're able to operate as a business. So we're going to try and ask you to do that under the right circumstances. Like, oh, here's this feature that exists. And if you want it, you got to upgrade to pro. So it's like it's a balance between, you know, making sure people see that and not being obnoxious about it. But of course that goes away the minute you are pro, you know, like we're not going to have the same upsells in place. Or I always find that a little obnoxious when you like upgrade an app and then they start bugging you even harder about their super platinum plan or something. And I think they do that on purpose because it's like, they know that you're the type of, they've identified you're the type of person who coughs up a credit card in a sense, you know?
They got you on the hook.
So maybe they can get you again, you know.
They just need to squeeze $5 more a month out of you. Mm. That's, well.
Well,
if you want to give $5 a month to ShopTalk, head over to shoptalkshow.com/scam and fill out the form. All right. Yeah. But we do have you can get posts delivered by a newsletter. So, and we will not bother you. So, all right. Next question. Derek Linebach writes in, I'm finding it quite the task to remove hover states on a mobile device on certain links. On mobile, the hover state causes the need to tap a link twice before it will take you to the page. But I like the cool effect when it's on the desktop. Any ideas would be awesome.
I ran into this the other day, and it was my bad, and I fixed it. And it was that... It was a link, and I was like, why is this taking two taps to do or whatever? And it's because I had attached a hover event on a parent element. You know, there was like a div or an li or something that had a hover on it that I just arbitrarily chose because I was lazy and did the wrong thing. And on desktop, it made sense to have that hover state there. But as soon as that hover state was there on something that wasn't an anchor link, it was an li or whatever, that's what caused the fact that you needed to tap it twice, because you tapped it once and it was like, oh, I better do the hover for the parent element that's not a link. Then if you clicked it, it would work. So it's like, I guess in my mind, I'm thinking of like, just stop, just don't do that. Like don't put a hover on things that aren't links on mobile, unless you are asking for that behavior, which you're usually not.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what's tough is the event stack. It like will fire like all the events when you tap something. It's like on touch start, on touch end, or what, you know, on touch start, on click, on, or no, on touch start, on hover, on click, like all of those fire in succession. So you have to kind of like, I don't know, it's a tough thing. I honestly, like, I've kind of like backed away from a lot of hover state trickery. Just because you can't guarantee a mouse in most circumstances. I know that's a bummer and I know that's boring, but my coworker Trent Walton, I'll cite this post. He wrote a post called On Hover, and it's an old post. It was kind of like when the iPad was coming out. We were like, oh, wow, okay, this is like for real now. this is like... like, actually, we can't depend on it. So we might have to kind of change our kind of, I don't know, we might have to get rid of the crutch, I guess is what Trent kind of calls it. Like, get rid of that sort of experiential crutch. But, yeah, I don't know. But it's also weird, too. Like, we put a little subtle hover on a button, and then you tap it. It turns kind of black, so you have to remove the WebKit tap highlight color on iOS. And then you have, like, that state will appear for just a bit, the hover state, and it maybe is like, and then like flashes, and then it's weird. So it's, I don't know, you kind of have, it's
just
tough.
By itself, anything that's an anchor link and there's no other weirdness going involved, it should not require a double tap, whether it has a hover or not.
No, right? It shouldn't. So sure. So that's
so there's like, something else going on. If you have to tap a link twice, there's something whack going on up the
side. Yeah, I would look in your code for like e.preventDefault, like event prevent default. That's
true.
Like
it could be a JavaScript thing, like you said, but it could be a CSS thing as well. Like it may just be CSS that's requiring that double tap, which is kind of my.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how it works with Target. Like, does Target Fire, you know, if you did like LI Target or something. Now I'm confused. But yeah, I think you'd, I don't know. Yeah, I think
I guess my, you know, I don't know. If you're in doubt and you're looking for a hard and fast rule, don't use hover states on non-link things.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty good. And probably like don't use JavaScript unless like you're very comfortable or I don't know. Like just JavaScript adds an extra level of shakiness to hover states, I think. But somebody else will probably disagree. Okay, next question.
Let's see. We got Ali Silviati writing in here. When I'm building sites and I want a background image path to come from the database, what I end up doing is using an inline background image in the inline styles, basically, or a style block that I just inject on the page. This is the cleanest way I can think of handling the problem, but it's still got a bit of code smell about it. How do you handle this use case? Is there a nicer way? No, Ali, I don't think there is. I don't think there's any shame. And, you know, if you need it to be a background image, let's say you're like, I don't know, like the Twitter header or something, you're like, upload a file that's going to be for your user profile's header area. You know, I think it's perfectly fine to have some div element up there in which that you apply an inline style background to. The reason that you do that and not put it in a style sheet is because it's only for one person in the world. You know, you wouldn't generate a CSS file and then have that CSS file be downloaded just for that user. That seems like a little heavy-handed of an approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I do it all the time, so I'm not going to say it's a bad thing, but I have wondered about the performance of it. You know, if you have like an image asset, does it fetch differently than a CSS asset? Does it cause kind of weird repainting, you know? But I think, yeah, I think that just sort of, you know, is it, I mean, if that image is content or I guess it's decoration, but if it's kind of like dynamic content, you can't really do a CSS file. You could do a style block in the head of your document. But you know, that's really, I don't know. That's an extra level of abstraction to me. That's kind of unnecessary. So I would probably just do it in line. I know.
I don't know. I mean, the bad thing I can think of is like the high specificity of that, but it's like, I don't know. You're being very explicit about what you're wanting to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's not a big fine. Deal. I'm going to say it's fine.
Adam Kalinske then writes in, you want to read this one?
And if you're using React, it's actually a best practice. So, okay, next. All right, Adam Kalinske writes in, hi, guys. I have a really interesting topic to discuss about creating web designs. At the moment where I work, we use Adobe Illustrator to create designs for the project we code up. As a developer, I like to use Photoshop to create my web designs away from work. Okay, so he's doing extra work. Photoshop can be quite outdated when you compare it features to Illustrator. Illustrator's usability being far more superior due to the swatches and the ability to create SVGs. Envato still uses Photoshop as a requirement when producing web designs. So if you're selling designs on Envato, you have to use...
I guess. Is that true? Or maybe it's if you work at Envato.
Yeah, no, no. So what would you say are the most cutting-edge softwares to be using when creating new web designs? Give a shout out to Creative Services and Online Services at Acer. Okay.
Hey, great. Shout out Acer.
Free, yeah, I don't know. Advertising.
There's a lot of like loadedness to this question, you know, just declaring Illustrator the superior software. I'd say I use them both regularly too, but rarely do I, not that I like sit around all day like designing 10 websites, you know, you all know the caveats when it comes to Dave and I. But rarely do I like, I'm like, I'm going to lay out this entire website in design software. I feel like those days are over for a lot of us just because it feels like the process these days is a lot more bouncy, back and forthy about and like working in smaller components and building up to bigger things. I know that's absolutely not true for a lot of people. They design complete sites and stuff, but Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how many businesses are like being like, oh, that's clearly the most superior software in the world for laying out entire sites is Adobe Illustrator. I would think a lot of shops that are doing that, let's flesh out the whole thing. I'd say there's probably a lot happening in Photoshop still. And then, of course, all the hip kids on Sketch and more, you know, kind
Sketch,
of boutique,
Figma.
Boutique-sa. Sure, all those, yeah. We had Koi on the show, and we were mm-hmm. talking about all those kind of fancy design tools. But I wouldn't you think that Photoshop's still probably the predominant software in use?
I would think so, but I have this Surface that the Dave goes Windows Surface, and
Do you have the Adobe suite on there? You don't even have it.
I don't even have Photoshop installed. I have Illustrator because it's great for SVG and icon sets and things, but I don't even have Photoshop. I didn't even install it on this. So maybe it's not. I've been using it for over a year now without Photoshop. So,
I mean, 80% of my Photoshop usage is light color correction, cropping, and resizing.
Yeah. Well, and that said, I work with two designers, so they can Photoshop things as necessary, but we do a lot more in code. We do so much in code. It's interesting. CodePen isn't considered a design tool or whatever, but it very much is for me and my coworkers. We do a lot in CodePen. It's just write things and see what happens and spit it out, and there you go. So
Adam is specifically asking, what is the most cutting edge software to use with new designs? I would think that, like we talked about on the Koi show, that I don't know if there's a good answer for that. We're in a weird phase in this world where the tooling is very split apart, and the clear winners have not been drawn, nor maybe they never will be. Just think of how many JavaScript libraries there are and different CMSs and stuff like that. There's a proliferation of them, and it's kind of good for the web, and that might just happen to design tools as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've been build out a whole site using Webflow. Are you familiar with Webflow? It's
Yes, it's very, very powerful.
Very WYSIWYG-y site. And I've been building a whole thing in it. And you drag elements onto the page, you drag a div or a section or a dynamic list that you will populate with your database. There are some weird limitations, and that could be a whole other thing. But you basically, when you go to style, all the styling is done in basically a web inspector on the right hand side of the page. And so
you're dragging you're dragging sliders around to change values, right? And picking colors. It's very much like a GUI for design.
Yeah, it's a GUI for websites. And so, it's kind of great, you can't do everything before, after elements or something like that, but man, you can do just about everything you want. Is it a design tool? Is it a drag and drop Dreamweaver-y thing? I don't really know, but it feels like a design tool that you can produce actual web pages with, cause you just hit publish and then it's out there on the web, and it's a really fast Node app or something. And so that's, I don't know. My I'm kind of into that. I kind of think it's great. I wouldn't recommend it or even talk about it if I wasn't kind of it's kind of okay. We wouldn't have ever given it to a client. But our client really wants to live update everything, every piece of text ever. And I was just this is actually a really good tool for that. So that's kind of what we're going with.
Think
about, think outside the box, mm-hmm. think outside the bun, Taco Bell. Speaking of sponsors, Taco Bell. No, I read that wrong, Chris.
No, we have an awesome sponsor here. Let's roll it.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Theme Juice. The URL there is themejuice.it. This is a Mac app, users. It's something we talk about a lot, how to manage all the stuff you have to do around WordPress. For one thing, how do you get a local dev environment going on? That's what Theme Juice is. It's a way to spin up a Vagrant environment that is a virtual server for your LAMP stack, everything that WordPress needs to run. It's super fast. It can fire them up right away. This is local software, so you have unlimited local projects that you're doing this with. And then it doesn't just give you just a WordPress install. You can customize the WordPress install. Be like, use this theme and this configuration and these plugins, so that when you spin up another one, you can use that starter template and have another dev environment going with that same stuff, which is pretty good. You don't have to mess around with your host file. It has a DNS server in it, so you can, have a URL for your site that's just easy, and it just comes with this software. All your build tool stuff, you can integrate it and just have one click, run these build tools on this theme, which is pretty good. It handles, and this used to be the Shop Talk Show question of the year was how do I keep my database in sync between local and live with WordPress? This does that too. So it's just everything you need to do DevOps-y around WordPress with local software on your Mac. It's called Theme Juice. Check it out at themejuice.it, or even better, follow the link in the show notes. We're back. I was reading ahead a little bit here. This one's from Alyssa Hope, who has a very interesting question here about how programming might affect more in your life than just what you do for a living. Alyssa says, I started learning to code almost a year now, and I've found that thinking in code changes the way I see and reason about lots of things in general life. Forming good habits to learn persistence, find value in failure, and be patient with complexity has, for me anyway, been at least as difficult as learning the nuts and bolts of new languages. Your podcasts have been great at giving information about new technologies while also letting me see some of your process and attitudes as you come across new things. Are there any particular habits or attitudes you can think of that have stuck with you throughout your career and helped you become a better developer? So, yeah, that's something I don't think this exact topic has ever come up before on Shop Talk Show, at least so specifically, is that, is there kind of life lessons you can learn from Alyssa? Alyssa's saying that, good habits and persistence and value and failure and patience is a part of programming, such as it is a part of life as well.
Mm-hmm.
Bad way to word it, but.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever kind of thought about it that way, but it's definitely, I think there's a lot of crossover, even, I don't know, the type of person you are is probably reflects the type of developer you are or whatever. But, I've been thinking about, when I'm always hesitant to jump into a code thing or just start coding. I want to think about it. Which is kind of good, but it's also maybe I do that too much. So I for a long time had to psych myself up. It's just do it. Just what's that? Shia LaBeouf, do it. I had to convince myself, just get in there and mess it up. Break your computer if necessary. Just learn that. And I think that's also, I don't know, that's kind of crossed over to my life a little bit too. It's now it's I'll just do it. I'll just whatever, just mow the lawn. I'll just do it. Just get her done. So I don't know if that, what do you think, Chris? What's your thoughts to this question?
Well, what it made me think of is, it's nice to think and ruminate about the positives of all of this, I'm not afraid to learn any new thing because I've learned so many new things. Every day is a logic puzzle for me to solve through. So can't everything else be a logic puzzle? If my car burns out a light, a headlight, I'm not afraid of that anymore. I'm be like, well, it's just a problem. I'm sure I can tackle it in little steps. Well, how do I open the hood of my car? Where do I expect to be able to pull things out? How do I Google for the things that I need? Is there resources I can attach to? Maybe that's not a perfect analogy, but you know what I mean? Any problem in life, you can kind of, with patience and persistence and multiple failures, you can figure out anything. It also teaches you a little bit of how to learn. I've one of the things I've been thinking about recently is I know what it takes to learn a new thing.
And it's not necessarily through program, but it could work this way with dance or music or anything, is that if I want to learn a new thing, I know that I need to surround my life with it. I can get a book on it and I can read the book, but I also have to do the work. I had to figure out that stuff too. And it'd be nice if I had some friends who are into it too, so we could talk about it. Maybe I can meet some people. Maybe I'll have some real life people I can talk to about it. Maybe I'll have a online community about it as well. And maybe I'll watch some YouTube videos about it. Maybe there's a podcast I can subscribe to about it. If you really want to learn something, going all in like that is kind of like the only way to do it. Maybe I can take some lessons too. Maybe I can go to the library and look stuff up about it. That's the way to get good at it. You can't just like go buy a mandolin and be like, well, I bought this and I bought the book and I'm going to get better at it. You know, it's like, it's not enough. You need to be like, you know, listening to mandolin music and I don't know, you need to surround yourself by it. And that factors into programming too. You know, if like I'm going to build a website, you got to kind of go all in, you know, you can't just take the one course. There's like a million different ways that you got to tackle it. And if you do all of those things, then you can get better at it. And that's both good and bad. It's good in the sense that you know how to get better at something, but it locks other things out, 'cause you can't have 10 hobbies like that, 'cause there's just enough kind of hours in the day. So that's one thought. I'm sorry, I'm just rambling about this, but then,
no, that's good. That's good.
Who's the pinboard guy? How do you say his name? It's Mache something. He's great. He's hilarious on Twitter and just a very interesting guy. Gives great talks, and then he posts the talks online to read. He gave one recently. I'll link it up in the show notes if I can find it. But he kind of called out programmers in it in a funny but all too real kind of way. And it was about this like attitude that you can develop as a programmer where you think that if you can program computers, that you're just such a genius that you can think your way out of anything. Politics, that's nothing compared to these, you know, programs I write at work. Just, you know, give me the opportunity and I'll think my way out of that, you know, that it develops this like godlike attitude in some people that they think because they're a good programmer, they're good at absolutely anything in life.
Mm-hmm.
So I worry about that also.
Well, I think the creator of Dilbert recently tweeted, he was like, name one thing I couldn't become an expert in 1 hour after talking with somebody. And it was just like, dude, Dilbert, what are you talking about? That's ridiculous. So yeah, it can kind of lead to this, I don't know, every problem's a software problem and we'll just solve it using tech because we're techies.
So there's, you know, not to say that there's not value you can take in learning anything. So that was quite the rant, and I'm not sure I had good points, but I'll just tell you, those things are rattling around in my head right now.
So are there any habits or attitudes you can think of that have stuck with you through your career and helped you become better? You said, you know, you have to learn. Persistence. I think for me, it's like just doing, like just trying it, just getting going after it has been a big one. And I think, I don't know. I'm trying to think of other things. So
I don't know. We can leave it at that. That's good luck, Alyssa. Please write back if you have, you know, the longer you go on this stuff and the whatever you take from programming into your real life. And anybody else out there, if there's things that you've learned through being in tech that you've taken to the rest of your life as an interesting metaphor, write in and we'll play them on the show. Eric Mullins writes in here, I have traditionally worked in statically typed languages like Java and Scala. Scala? Never used it. I've heard of it, of course, but you know. But in the past year, I've gotten more into JavaScript, React in particular, and web design, which is dynamically typed as opposed to statically typed. At first, I was very uncomfortable working in a dynamic environment, but I'm getting used to it now. I recently came across type implementations for JavaScript. What are your thoughts on types in JavaScript? Technologies like Microsoft's TypeScript or Facebook's Flow for React seem to be getting more popular. What are some of the pros and cons? In what situations do you think one outweighs the others in the context of web applications? Here's an embarrassing thing, Dave. I've, you know, been in this industry long enough. I've heard statically typed languages and dynamically typed languages. I've heard that said many times. I admit, I don't really get it. Do you get it in a good way? Can you explain to me what the difference between those types of languages are?
I think. Let me explain it badly. Is that okay?
So better than not at all.
So, you know, in JavaScript, you say var foo equals whatever I want it to be. String, a number, an array, an object. It can be anything, right? When you do like a statically typed language, and I'm kind of going off of like C-sharp stuff I do for video games, you know, you have to say like public var integer my number equals 3.
Is that the only difference? Like you have to, if it's a string, you got to say it's a string. If it's a...
Yeah. Yeah. It's okay. Kind of like it can't, a string can't suddenly become an array or something like that. You can't like kind of mix and muddle these kind of types. And so
I see. So in JavaScript, you can say like quote Dave plus one and it'll be Dave one. And it's perfectly happy to take an integer and smash it onto a string.
Yep. And so in, and you can be like, does Dave equal true? And it's like, yep. Or what, you know, does
which
Dave
is weird because now you're comparing a Boolean to a string, and yeah, I guess yeah. I'm just so used to that just through JavaScript mostly.
So there may be more to it that like I'm missing because I am not a professional computer scientist. But it's kind of just this idea that things have strict rules, like buckets or variables have rules applied to them that they can't break out of.
So it'll just error. Like if you try to run that page, it won't just be like, yeah, that's weird, but I'm just going to try to deal with it. It's just going to be like, Bart, nope, nope.
Yeah. Or if you are like Dave plus one, like string Dave in quotes plus one in JavaScript, what do you get?
Well, Dave one, like I said,
Dave one. Yeah. And so, but if you do, that in like a statically typed language, it'll say like, no, you can't add strings and numbers.
So do people get used to that and then like it because there's like less surprises?
Yeah, kind of less rules and less sort of WTFs. Maybe your math works better. So yeah, it's kind of this.
Almost feels right in JavaScript because it's like HTML is so loosey goosey. You know, like it'll do its darndest to render a page that's just full of problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's CSS too. It's like kind of designed to be like, oh, I don't know what that is. Bye. I'll try it, but if I don't get it,
let's say if you analyzed every single like HTML and CSS file on the internet, like over 50% of them would have some kind of error. So imagine a world in which that was a hard error and the page didn't render at all, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, JavaScript is kind of more like, no, let me try to figure this out. Let me, I'll see what I can do with this.
It was kind of a philosophical difference in designed.
Yeah. And I mean, that's probably, you know, there's got to be like memory and compilation concerns and things like that. Just like, you know, what this does has to, you know, it expects.
Oh, yeah. Maybe it's actually more efficient in statically typing. So, and then Eric also mentions the fact that it's like, okay, maybe the reason that TypeScript, like one of the reasons it exists is because of developers who really preferred that now can bring that to JavaScript. And that, mm-hmm. and then when they compile their TypeScript, it will bother them about errors. We actually, you know, just yesterday we got one of these, but we've gotten a number of them at CodePen over the years because we support TypeScript on CodePen, but we only in the like kind of the loosest possible way. Our TypeScript implementation is like not very good. It just, I don't know, it just, we just run it in Node and we just send stuff to it and it sends it back. But I think people really like to like configure their TypeScript and have it like compile and give them proper error reporting and stuff. Like you can declare a type in CodePen and set us. And like, you can say like, well, I don't know, I forget the exact syntax. You can say, this is a string and it's Dave. And then you can set Dave to one and it won't throw an error. But it should throw an error because that's what TypeScript's for, in a sense. Yeah. It's not the only thing it's for, but I think. But it's. So what do you think? Like, do you enjoy statically typed languages? Or have you tried TypeScript?
I haven't tried TypeScript. I think... I think TypeScript is, you know, it's for people like Eric and, you know, that sounds like a slur, but let me try that again. I think it's for people with like a background of static typing and you want things, you expect things to work a certain way. I think that's actually kind of good. I think it's applying a rule set around JavaScript that it probably should have had. I mean, I don't know. It's a little weird that you can.
Do you think that's why things like Angular were written in it? It's because like, okay, this is a, you know, this is a very big framework. We need to make sure that we're doing a very good job with this thing. And by choosing to write it in TypeScript that they're able to like test it better. And it's like, you kind of get some kind of testing for free with it.
Yeah. You get kind of like validation, you know, like if you think like, you know, like when in HTML, it's like, You submit a form, you know, like, wouldn't it be cool if you had like, we do kind of now, but you can just web inspect and get around it. But like validation for inputs, like this is a string. This should, you know, this should not just be a number, or this is a number. It should only be a number. That's, you know, I don't know, something to think about.
Funny, isn't it? It's kind of like a lazy way of testing. Like, I just thought of this, so maybe I'm way wrong, but like, you know, you can write tests in JavaScript to enforce things not being a string when they're not supposed to be a string or whatever, getting the right input that you expect to get. But you don't, you know, you wouldn't even necessarily need to write a certain type of test if from the beginning you said this expects to be an object, so it better stay an object.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, you could kind of like, you wouldn't have to have like assert is a number or whatever,
right?
It would just always be a number that's kind of like built into the language.
You know, I know it was Sasha Grief, I think, put out us the state of JavaScript big form thing and was releasing data on it, and it matched up what I've been feeling as well. As the people that like TypeScript really like it, and there's an awful lot of people who haven't tried it yet who are very interested to try it. It seems to have pretty good momentum. I say I'm interested in it, but you know, don't often have an opportunity to start a big project in a new language like that, but I can give it a star that indicates my interest. I don't know.
That's about all I can get. No, I think it's important. I think it is like, you know, it's maybe a fault of JavaScript that it doesn't have this. But you know, it's also very convenient to add strings and numbers and be like, yeah, it just spits out what I want it to, you know? I don't know. I think it's something to, I don't know. I've been reading that Imposter's Handbook. We mentioned it on a show before.
Oh, you bought it?
Yeah, I bought it and I've been reading it. It's very interesting. It just the different ways to store data, like a list or a dictionary or a hash and just kind of the arrays and just kind of the like micro differences in those things. It's all very interesting. It's all stuff you probably know if you do enough, you know, programming and JavaScript and stuff, but it's nice to have it just kind of spelled out for you. So anyway, hopefully I explained that well. Yeah, I know it static type is good in when I do video game programming in Unity and C#, but it is also confusing. It's like, I don't know what this thing is. You know, that happens to me a lot. Like, it's a component. So what is it? You know, I don't know. So anyway, all right. Hopefully we answered that. Okay, Eli Brumley writes in, I have found building client sites is both exciting and challenging. The biggest hurdle of the process is the final site. My projects often end up a bloated performance mess. I think the web design community has done a good job of talking about things like mobile first and optimizing site speed. I'm a big fan of 10K Apart and other projects that encourage these good behaviors, but clients don't seem to care. What will push these ideas to the top? Google's algorithm, web community education. Can y'all give any insight on best practices that would help prevent shipping sluggy sites?
Wherever Eli works, they find themselves, I don't know, Eli cares about performance, but for whatever reason, somewhere during the process, what ends up shipping at the end of these projects is, in his words, a bloated mess, right? Is that, what does it say mm-hmm. here?
Yeah.
Sluggy
performance
site.
Mess.
So what's going on? There's a breakdown that's happening there. Somebody at the top in this chain doesn't care. Maybe it's, is it a, it, it, I mean, you're the one who built the site, so it's somebody kind of okayed it on your side, but the clients are pushing for it so hard that maybe you felt you had no choice but to do that. And then you're also saying, like, oh, maybe there'll be some kind of thing that comes along, some straw in the camel's back that allows this to not be possible anymore. So if Google said, well, any site that is over this weight or takes this long to load or something, we're not even going to index it or something crazy like that, then all the clients would be asking for, like, please, please remove images from my site. I hate heroes now. No more carousels. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So DoubleClick just released a study. We could maybe find it and link to it here, but, you know, this kind of data is what's gonna, like convince people who have money, but it's, if a site doesn't load in 3 seconds on 3G, like 53% of people leave, like if it hasn't loaded.
They have a real study on that. That's pretty damning.
Yeah, I mean, and that's Google publishing this. That's not Dave Rupert just riffing.
Right.
That's like Google DoubleClick. The reason most sites are slow, advertisements, which is interesting that DoubleClick kind of published this. But that, I mean, so I think we've talked about it on the show before, but, you know, if you follow Alex Russell on Twitter, he talks a lot about, you know, the web is in trouble and doomsday sort of things. And you may kind of be yay or nay on that. But there it is kind of like the data is showing huge bounce rate for 3 seconds. I mean, it's hard to get your website to load in 3 seconds. And but like if 53% of people are bouncing after 3 seconds. I mean, that's a huge deal. And the average mobile website takes up like 19 seconds to load.
Wow. So, what I like about Eli writing in here is a lot of us developers talk about and quote and put slides in our slide decks that says, look at this line, this growth chart of how big websites are getting. It's like the, you know, to some degree, the web's getting faster and faster because of the connection speeds that we have, but still we're beating that and more with how large we're making websites, which is insane, right? And so Eli's, you know, and a lot of us are like, you know, I don't know, we don't make websites like that, but the world does kind of thing. And Eli's straight up taking responsibilities. Like, I see this as a problem, and I'm part of the problem. All the sites we produce are going this direction. So what do you see, Dave, as the moment this turns around?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, I think it's all the fun stuff gets taken away from us. You know, Google is already rewarding AMP sites, like a lot of different AMP sites, like from they kind of just announced that they're rolling it out AMP little badges across the board, you know, and once users figure out that little, and Bing is rolling out AMP sites too. And so like once people realize that little lightning bolt icon means fast, you know,
you think people will get it right away, like the general population or whatever.
Oh, I mean, if you're like looking at a phone and it's like Washington Post, lightning bolt, CNN, you know, it's going to take 40 seconds to load. Which one are you going to click?
So that's a big deal, right? The logo they chose for it is a lightning bolt, mm-hmm. which does have some pretty clear indication that it's going to be fast.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, I don't like AMP. I've said this before. I think it's like a very, I don't know. I feel like it's just a subset of everything, and it just doesn't, you know, like you have to use this Google thing to do.
Are you saying, but at the same website? Time, you kind of get it because these are the kind of bold industry moves that tell people like this can't go on.
Yeah. I mean, I think somebody called it like a Dion Almer, I think called it like a bitter pill for the internet. It's just that it has to like, we have to make our websites faster. 3 seconds on 3G is like the line. Multiple people have said that. And if you follow all the browser people, all of them, all browsers are like, we are trying to execute too much JavaScript on load and it's choking browsers. So like your React site, your Ember site, probably not going to cut it. Even if you do server side rendering, like they're just like overloading browsers with how much, you know, you can be like, oh, I'm only delivering like 300K of JavaScript, but that like 300K turns into like it, you know, when it gets unuglified and all executed, you know, it's like 40 megs of RAM or something, you know? And so it's just like, just huge. It turns into a huge amount of code. So
it's funny how identically this topic is to human health in the United States of America. It's like all professionals agree that it's like this can't go on. Human beings can't continue to get as unhealthy as they are in this country. And oh my God, it's amazing what we're putting in our bodies.
Or even carbon, you know, like that, like it's, we're filling the air with, sorry, a Custigan. Hopefully that horse sound effect came across, but we're filling the air with garbage. And like, you know, what do we expect that's going to happen? It's like, people are going to start saying, I don't want garbage, or I don't want garbage from garbage companies or whatever. So I think it's going to start, you know, we're going to see a change in how websites are built. And what I kind of don't like about it is Google's making the shots. Like Google's saying, well, you can only have these elements, you know, and that's a bummer to me. But, you know, that I think it's the reality. If we want money to keep pouring into websites, we have to keep websites being fast and good. And so, you know, these, I mean, I think I measured the Shop Talk Show site. That it takes a long time to load the Shop Talk Show site on 3G, kind of an embarrassing amount of time, but it's a very simple site. So we've dropped the ball somewhere, you know, it's just probably some kind of minification or something. So, you know, we just have to figure it out. I think all of us have to kind of work on things. And that's probably it too, is it's just too easy to make a website. Like you just spin up a WordPress and you put a theme and you bingo bingo. Like it's probably very easy to make a website. It's very hard to make a good website. So I think that's the situation we're in.
You got me worried here. So we got a full second to grab the full copy of jQuery. That could probably go. So there's a few wins in here, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I mean,
maybe we'll go system fonts.
System fonts.
Another topic for another day. I don't know. Sometimes I wake up and I'm like, you know, I'm not even worried about it. You know, life will find a way, kind of Jurassic Park moment kind of thing. Like do you think the web really will die? And what happens if it does die? Like, is that the world's greatest loss? I mean, yes, I don't want the world to die. Don't, you know, I don't know, get me wrong about this or whatever, but I just think that things get bad, things get better. You know, well, I don't know. Yeah, maybe the political climate has got me feeling that this way.
Yeah, I mean, political climate. We're about to elect a cool person. So, you think about like CSS Tricks or even Shop Talk. You'd have to download the Shop Talk app to listen to the Shop Talk show. So already, like, no one's doing that. And then you'd have to, like, all the money we'd make, we'd have to give 30% over to Apple. You know, it's kind of like, there's sort of like I think you, when you sacrifice the web, you hand it over to a native platform. You know, I can't think of a single native platform that's just like, yeah, make as much money as you want off of us, you know? So I don't know. I think that's sort of, or, you know, you release the coolest fart website you've ever made. And Apple's like, no, we have enough fart websites. And you're like, mine's different though. And they're like, no, sorry, you can't release a fart website and make money off of your dream. That's a problem, I think. So I think, like, we need to have websites and companies and everything investing in websites. That said, I think progressive web apps are a, like, fantastic step forward in that. So.
Wow, it all comes back around. Let's see, do we have time for one more? I guess
I think maybe. We get time for one more, or do you want? I guess we've done a lot, and we have advertisements and things, and we should probably.
Well, let's just be quick. Alon Dahari writes in about. I recently learned about SAS's placeholder classes. You've seen those, haven't you, Dave? Mm-hmm. Even though you're kind of off the SAS, are the ones that start with the number or the percentage.
Percent.
Yeah. I felt like I discovered the Holy Grail. I feel like this is going to allow me to use things like Smacks without ending up with bloated HTML. You take all those classes that you might use, you know, like you got a button class, but then button danger and button big and all that stuff. Alana is saying, well, just make those placeholder classes and then take a quote unquote semantic class name and extend all of those together. And now you have one class name that when you used to have three. So yeah, I kind of definitely felt the same thing when I saw SAS placeholder classes. I think I was like, oh my God, you know, you could have every framework. You could load Foundation and Bootstrap, and if, as long as they made them all placeholder classes, it doesn't matter because you just extend what you need out of them, and it outputs nothing other than what you've asked for, which is cool. I just don't think it ends up really being that holy grail-y in the end for whatever reason. Alan then says, though, I learned about un-CSS, which is, you know, we've talked about this a number of times. Basically, it looks through your CSS, figures out what you're not using, and removes it. Which I've always like squinted my eyes at a little bit because I'm like, did it look at every single page of your entire website and every single state that it could possibly have? Because I just guarantee it didn't, you know?
Nope.
Yeah. So I don't know what to say about all this. Have you ever used a placeholder class? We could start there, I guess.
Yeah, I think they're cool. I think it's actually like everything I want out of extends. I just don't have to use extends, kind of. I don't know. But what's the difference between a mixin? I don't know, but there's a subtle difference, I guess. Mixins, you'd want to pass variables, and placeholders are just kind of...
You cannot pass a variable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But they're just... It's just like a named class. You know, if I wrote .dave as a class, I can extend that, too. That's a thing that I can extend. This is just if I do... percentage sign Dave, it will not output that unless I extend it.
But if you went like percentage sign Dave or like my button percentage sign Dave, and then you did my pizza percentage sign Dave, would it comma separate those things?
It would.
Oh, see, I don't like that. I'm not really? Into the comma, no commas.
Well, too bad. That's what extension does.
Okay, then I just would use a mixin. Sorry.
Okay. Mixins are a little easier to wrap your head around usually because and they don't mess with source order and are, you know, very gzip friendly and stuff. So yeah, I would think that generally a mixin is a easier thing to reach for, but it does, you know, if anything has bloat problems, it's just as much mixins as extends, I think.
No, for sure. I guess my thing with extends is like, you know, you're kind of working on a site and you're like, I'm just going to web inspector this thing and see if I can fix it. And then you can't, like, because you have like a 10 comma thing and the whole site falls apart when you change like a margin. That bothers me enough to where I would not use extends, like comma separated.
Extends and nesting does get pretty crazy.
So. Yeah, like it's like, you look at the selector and it's 52 like lines of code, you know, with like double dots and double triple dots things and hover states and all that. And you just want to change a color. And it's just like, oh no, like this is not going to work. And so that bothers me about extends enough to where I will not use them. So
I feel like I've seen it. I've seen people complain about that so many times that it has now entered in my mind the like, the cliche complaint. Like as soon as it's happened to anybody, they web inspect it, they take a tweet of it and they post it on Twitter and they say, look, this is what will happen to you if you use an extend. You know, I'm like,
yeah, I'm probably guilty, but it's like what I think extends could make your like code really, really awesome. But I also, I don't know, I've just had like trouble.
Me too. And me too. So we're in agreement there to the, all the way down to the point where I just don't even use them anymore.
Yeah. So, that, and that's, you know, you take extends out and that's where you start getting into the, maybe I don't need it. maybe I don't need SAS. That's where your brain starts going, man. You gotta be careful. Pretty soon you're going to be coding in .css files. What? Chris, careful. If you need me to write an actual CSS article for CSS Tricks, let me know.
I am. I feel like I've reached pre-enlightenment here. I'm just open to any idea these days. I'm just here to just facilitate the flow of the industry.
It's worth mentioning. We've both been in tree pose this whole episode. So if you think this episode has been better or different, it's completely due to our tree posing, our yoga that we've been doing.
I don't even know how I feel about it. We're recording on like a Friday afternoon and I'm just like, I don't even know if my brain works. Do I even have thoughts?
No, I've been drinking beer. So it's Friday, whatever. Okay. Well, thanks, dear listener, for downloading this and your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to star heart favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Tweet about it too. You can follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Get a brand new one. There's companies that want to hire you. Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com. Buy my book about SVG. It's really good.
I don't have an A Book Apart book, but, you know, bother them and tell them I should have one. Stockholm.